for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you sink like a stone, for the times they are a-changing. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again, and don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changing. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out the new one if you can't lend your hand, for the times they are a-changing. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last, for the times they are a-changing. Many of us wish that the times had changed a little more, or in a more positive direction. Well, you know, the times are always changing, of course. There's never a time when things aren't changing. And that's a good thing, generally. Life would be so boring, so incredibly boring, if nothing ever changed. But so often, it seems that the wrong things change, or they change the wrong way. Cops get more brutal. People hate even more than they did before. They hurt even more than they did before. The politicians' lies just keep getting ever bigger. Well, here on the New American Dream Radio Show, we're all about making changes, but changes for the better. You know, peace, love, and happiness may sound like just a slogan, some crazy drug-induced hallucination from the 60s, but it's not. It's an ideal. It's a goal. It's a way of life. We need a new American dream. We need to make that dream happen. And the way to do it is for each and every one of us to make things better in our own little corner of the world. We need to help each other. We need to love each other. Even when we don't feel like those around us deserve to be loved, we need to love them. Even when we don't feel like we deserve to be loved, we need to love ourselves, and we need to expect everybody else to love us too. We need to make such a big, strong feedback loop of loving that there's no way in the world to defeat it. Every time there's a choice between love and fear, we must never choose fear. We ought not even be tempted by it, because our strength is in love. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we stream live every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m., right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And right now, I'm very proud to present my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome back special guests Larry Pinkney, Anthony Racine, and M.K. Davis. And so tonight we are joining together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Duluth, Minnesota, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Chicago, Illinois, Benton, Mississippi, and wherever you are. I want to plug our mention, new book that we're involved in, Chuck and I and others. It's called, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. Go to Amazon.com to order. And I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. Okay, June 5th, 1968, 12:15 a.m., Ambassador Hotel, Los Angeles. The RFK anniversary, the anniversary of his murder. Go to Black Op Radio and listen to Dr. William Pepper talking about the recent developments in the case of Sirhan Sirhan. And on this new book, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, listen to a couple of great interviews. Jim Fetzer, one of them is Jim Fetzer and Nick Collerstrom with Mark Windows. And the show is Windows on the World, windowsontheworld.net. Also, another interview on the book, The Lorianne Fenton Show on this Revolution Radio Network. Also, The Michael Dresser Show on Blog Talk Radio. Check it out. Okay, something else. If you go here, you will find a map entitled History is a Weapon, Guerrilla War in the United States, 1965 to 1970. It's historyisaweapon.com. Hover your cursor over the marks and get details of many anti-government attacks in the U.S. from 65 to 70. Go here and see many people still in the United States prisons for actions taken against the United States military and government. And here, in this case, is thejerichomovement.com. Given what we know of fake terror events in recent years, are we to assume that all these events were organic? Here's something from Father Daniel Berrigan, who knew something about the political protest scene in those days. He said, I have a very great sense that there is going to be much more sabotage and that the government itself is inducing it. That's Father Daniel Berrigan, interview with Scanlon's Monthly while underground for Burning Draft Files at Catonsville, published January 1971 issue, Guerrilla War in the USA. But then again, when you search through those photos and names and descriptions on the Jericho Movement website, you will see in prison 20 years, in prison 38 years, 33 years, 41 years, and so it goes on and on. So in my mind, these folks are for real. Why are almost all of those people from the 60s and 70s, that era, the ones that are still in prison, is it because we have lost heart? I asked Jim Fetzer about this, and this is his response. Mike, Nixon ended the draft, and the consequences have been enormous. Most families no longer care about issues of war and peace, because they know that whatever happens, their children will not be affected. There were real reasons for the young to resist. Now they don't care. Well, there were also leftist bombings, leftists fighting back in the earlier part of the century and beyond, the 1920 Wall Street bombing, Haymarket Square bombing in 1886. Bomber raids began in July 1919 in response to alleged anarchist bombings in April and June of government officials, businessmen and law enforcement officials, including the home of Attorney General Alexander Palmer in Washington, D.C. It just seems to me kind of strange. All those people in jail for real resistance from decades ago, none now, and all now are false flag events. And, of course, there's always the question of violence versus not.
Folks, we seem to be having a problem with the with the sound here. I'm just going to take Mike out and bring him back in real quick and see if we can't get this back. In the meantime, I'm going to continue where Mike left off.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system. 7123.
I'll try to get Mike back later on. In the meantime, there's always the question of violence versus nonviolence. The questions here are more about the motivation of moving, getting off the sofa, out the door, down the street. Don't advocate violence, bombing. But I also have to insert that to contemplate such is to choose to become more deeply involved than when joining a march. with one pretty much guaranteed of being back in time for the pizza and beer. We don't have that now, except phony FBI crap to purport to have prevented terror events, when actually it's they who conduct the whole exercise. So I'm just amazed when I see these people, their photos, their descriptions, and beside it says 33 years in prison, 40 years in prison. They might say they're political prisoners, prisoners of war, class war, ideological warfare. We could decide to say that they belong there because they hurt people, stole money. We could also wonder what we would think of them if they were now in power rather than in prison. Did Franklin, Washington, Jefferson, Paine consider killing and theft beyond their reach, things they would not do to obtain freedom? We could choose to say that nonviolence is the only way to go, but how can we go forward without any thought to those who are still in prison for revolution, fighting against America, as we also say we are? And now, please join us for another episode of Sylvia Smith, Construction Zone Flag Person, the strongest, most interesting person on earth. Sylvia Smith is 5'2", 105 pounds. She makes direct eye contact with every driver. She smokes a pack of Marlboro Reds a day. Her 9-foot sign says stop and slow. Below those big words, it also says 9/11 was an inside job and Boston Strong is just wrong. She walks over to chat with the front car driver.
Automatic voice message system.
Whenever there's a holdup.
1, 2, 3, 4, 8.
Sorry, I was just trying once again to get my co-host back. They want to talk about the weather, how long it's going to take, where she's from, if she's single. She steps right on their lines and tells them that both Bushes should be in prison, that the FBI burned kids alive at Waco, and that the Oklahoma City bombing was way more than we were told by Clinton and Reno. Yeah, I guess, says the driver, trying to see around. Sylvia leans down low to see over to the passenger and the kids in back and tells them all that John Kennedy was killed by the CIA, same with his brother Robert and Martin Luther King Jr. She hands the kids suckers with wrappers that say nobody died at Sandy Hook, just democracy. The men on the paving crew don't mess with her. They've seen what happens when anyone has tried that. She talks on her radio to the boss, to the flagmen at the other end all day long, and none of it's about the Boston Red Sox or American Idol. Her beat-up old Chrysler is parked right there on the side, two tires in the weeds. She gets there at 5:30 a.m., after getting breakfast for her children. She's in constant contact with them by her phone throughout the entire day. The muscles in her arms bulge as she grips the sign, looking both ways, making sure her cars and her workers are safe. On a recent Friday, just before dusk, the other flag person had already left for home, along with the men on the paving crew, but Sylvia still had one more group. She let them go, sending them on their murderous American way with a peace sign and a dusty smile. Sylvia walked in her blistered, tired feet over to her car in the ditch, tried to start it, got out, put the hood up, lit her last cigarette, and in the waning light, she talked to her kids at home on the phone, adjusted some wires, then got into the car, roared off out of the ditch, leading a cloud of smoke down the road. Join us next week for another episode of Sylvia Smith, Construction Zone Flag Person, the strongest, most interesting person on earth. When we'll see Sylvia convince a bald eagle to come sit on her sign for a while and just shoot the bull. Our first guest tonight is M.K. Davis. And I'm going to give him a call right now.
Hello.
Well, hello, MK. It's Chuck and the New American Dream Radio Show. I've temporarily lost Mike, so if you hear any ringing in the background, it's because I'm trying to reconnect to him.
But, okay, no problem.
Please just go ahead. You're on the air.
All righty. Well, I tell you, what I'm going to talk about this week is a trip that I made and another researcher, Don Monroe, to the American Southwestern Desert. Now, this was in search of the Yucca Man, or the Southwest version of Bigfoot, the desert version of Bigfoot. And this all came about as a result of a book that I read. It's called Paranormal Joshua Tree. Now, a Joshua Tree is one of the big, tall, it looks like a halfway between a yucca plant and a tree. It's got bark on the lower end of it, but up at the top is the little needles there that stick you. Well, there was a gentleman who went by the name of Ranger X. He was a ranger there at Joshua Tree National Park. And he wrote a book called Paranormal Joshua Tree, where he anonymously named a lot of experiences that occurred in the park, and some of them were his own experiences, and some of them involved a Bigfoot creature or a Bigfoot-type creature, and as recently as 2014. So I got interested in it, and I read the book, and in the back of the book, they had a kind of a synopsis of the different campsites there in Joshua Tree National Park. So the one I became interested in, because they had a Bigfoot incident there in 2014, was the Black Rock Campground. Now, he's got in this synopsis, I'll read it to you, he said, Bigfoot or Yucca Man was seen in the hills behind the campground by both hikers and volunteer brush cutting crew. Tracks were also found, reportedly seen by the water district personnel traveling to outline the pump house, who stated that it was at least 9 feet tall. Well, you know, if it's a fresh sighting, you know, I'm interested in it. And so Don Monroe and I, we decided to go out there and check it out for ourselves. So all the cells in my body are still spinning around from crossing all those time zones. But we went there, and we spent a little time in Joshua Tree, talked to some of the rangers and a few of the campers and things, and a more beautiful place I don't think I've ever seen in its own way. It's got a lot of sandstone boulders and rocks, and there's a lot of caves and stuff like that to hide in. No question about it that the habitat's there, and it's not the desert in the way that Death Valley is the desert. Death Valley has very little growing. This actually has quite a few, plants that grow there, and there's a lot of cover, and it's a little moister. Get occasional rains, and it's not a bad place to be if you are a desert Bigfoot. We went to some of these campgrounds, and well, basically, you know, I kind of figured we'd have the park to ourselves, but that wasn't the case. It was quite full of people. And, of course, we made our way around to all the various campgrounds that were named on this little synopsis by Ranger X. And we didn't see anything. But even worse, we got the feeling that we weren't going to see anything. You know, that you ever get just a hunch? We got the feeling like that. So we decided that we would go to Plan B. And Plan B was that if we didn't find anything within a certain length of time at the Joshua Tree National Park, that we would leave there, travel through the Mojave Desert north into Death Valley. And from Death Valley, we would try to explore. So we did do that. We went north through the Mojave, went by the largest sand dune in the North American continent, saw a storm in the desert, which was a real rare thing. And then I looked up on the side of a mountain while I was driving, and I saw this little tiny black speck. And this speck was, I mean, so small. But I got my camera out, zoomed it all the way in, and then I got the picture and zoomed it in, and it did appear to be, you know, a hole in the side of the mountain there. So I stopped. I got Don stopped, and we kind of thought about it a little bit. It was 115 degrees. The wind was blowing just ferociously. And I went up there. I made my way up there to that thing. And it was an old mine shaft. And all around the entrance to that mine shaft were tracks of some of the strangest sorts that I believe I've ever seen. I still do not know what to make of them. There were two different types. One looked like an elephant's footprint. It was almost pegged in its shape. Very heavy. It cut deep into the soil, had straight up and down ridges, you know, around the sides. And then there was another one that had what appeared to be three fingers or either three toes. And we still haven't totally made up our mind whether we were looking at a handprint or a footprint. Because if it was a footprint, the toes were long like a finger. So Don is a pretty good caster, a plaster, and he had plaster with him. So we went back up there, and up at the top where you can't see it from the highway, because this is much older than the highway, there is a cairn built. And I don't know if you know what a cairn is, but it's like a spiritual thing. This was a ring of rocks that somebody had built. And inside the ring of rocks, there was a flat platform and a pyramid-shaped rock was standing up on its end on that platform. And this was so old that the rock had patina on it. And patina is oxygenation from being out in the elements, which will turn the stone darker than it is naturally. So you could pick up one of the rocks and look underneath, and it was bright red. You put it back down and it's almost black. So I know it was very old, this particular cairn, and it was probably situated in an astronomical alignment of some sort, but it was worth going back up there and try to cast some of those tracks. So we did. And let me tell you something now. Now, my friend Don, getting up there in age, he's 79 years old. But, you know, but he could beat me easily. We went up there and he casted the tracks. And at some point in time, you know, we'll publish pictures of them. I don't really know what I'm looking at there, because we found similar tracks in northern Nevada in the high desert. And I'm not sure what it came from. It's like no match found. It's not your typical Bigfoot track, that's for sure. But is it big? It is big, and it's a foot. Bigfoot. So we got the coordinates on it and everything, and then we left after we got our casts out of the ground, and we made our way on up to Pahrump, Nevada. Spent the night there, and then went into Death Valley the next day. Death Valley is a little hotter. Death Valley is 120 degrees. And we went out into the valley, and we were looking specifically for something that we had seen on a previous trip out there. And what it was fossilized tea worms from the kind that live on the deep ocean floor near these chemical hydrothermal vents. They live a symbiotic lifestyle. They have no sunlight, and they're dependent on the chemicals coming out of the ground. So we were out there for that, and we did successfully relocate them and find them. But out there in the middle of that vast emptiness, there was another rock cairn. And this rock cairn was sitting on a promontory overlooking some fantastic desert scenery. And it just reminded me that somewhere, somehow, sometime in the past, that there was somebody out there that wanted to remain relevant in some way, or to make a statement that I was here. You know, the Death Valley has got endless mysteries. And of course, my friend Don Monroe is he's a man who seeks out the strange. And, you know, to imagine, you know, someone his age going out there, but and to say that we didn't suffer any ill effects, I can't say that. We got very, very hot. We came back, and I went over and cut on my air conditioner on my Jeep. And I came back to get Don, and Don had done fallen down on the ground and was totally out of it. And this lady from Paris, France, a French lady, came over there, and she asked a few things about him, and Don heard her voice, and I've never seen a man come that close to levitation. He literally floated off the ground. And I know there's a lot of things that can rescue a man, cold water, cold beer, but a lady speaking in a French accent worked for him. So, you know, we were able to survive the Death Valley in the middle of the summer at 120 degrees.
Well, that seemed like a great place to break the story. And thank you so much, MK, for being with us every month. And we look forward to the next time.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Chuck.
This public service announcement brought to you by Rolage and the American Spelling Bee Council of Bowling Green. How do you spell Al-Qaeda? Can you use that in a sentence, please? Yes, Al-Qaeda, the evil towel heads what drove the planes into the towers and the Pentagon, and now we have to take our clothes off to fly in an airplane, and they do more stuff every day, it seems, and we are scared of them, so we don't care if we have freedom of speech or nothing, because we are Americans, and we have car racing, and we can still kill animals, and we have our guns to keep us safe from deer and elk, and we salute the troops and the flag and the parade and say, way to go killing those kids in the mountains over there, because it was Bush who did 9/11 and not those kids, and we really don't know nothing. The word origin, evil. How do you spell Al-Qaeda? Is it A-L-Q-U-A-D-A, A-L-K-A-Y-D-A, A-L-Q-A-E-D-A, A-L-Q-A-I-D-A, E-L-Q-U-E-D-A? We spell it C-I-A every time. Now please join us as we look in on the new CBS reality TV show, One Day in the Life of an American Solzhenitsyn. A prisoner, an American prisoner, recently looked out from his prison window, a high prison window, in the middle of a big city, down on the little people and little cars below. Behind him on his coarse blanket, on his bed, various newspapers and magazines were strewn about because he was allowed to have information coming in, just none going out. The dates on the papers and magazines were behind the times, but they did get there eventually. He was not allowed pencil or paper, but he was allowed to think. And as he did every day, he thought out the letter that he would send to everyone when he someday got that chance. He was for some reason sure that what he had to say would be news to those below, which it surely would be. Who are the real terrorists and who are the freedom fighters, he wondered. It depends, doesn't it? Where you are sitting, whose newspaper you are reading. Would our own U.S. government take part in an atrocity in order to bring about a sense of fear in society? If so, why? Why would that sense of fear be so important to them to do such a thing? Maybe it is mental illness, guns, people getting fed up with bullies and exploding, people getting fed up with all these idiots everywhere around them. But I think there's just too much of a pattern here to be content with that explanation. I think rather than following our own pattern of saying low nut every time and never getting past that, I think the time has come to say government, CIA, FBI, and then prove it was not, and then go on from there. Remember the D.C. sniper, the underwear bomber, the shoe bomber, September 11th, Oklahoma City? How about the burial of Osama bin Laden at sea, the illustrated tall tale of Jessica Lynch, the lies about Pat Tillman, the stolen presidential elections of 2000 and 2004? Bush wasn't even a real president. Think of that. Weapons of mass destruction, Colin Powell at the UN and a decade earlier, the lie about Iraqi soldiers taking babies out of incubators and leaving them to die, which helped lead to the first Gulf War. The lies about why Pearl Harbor really happened. The lies about the circumstances around the death of Senator Paul Wellstone. The lies about the whole history of the U.S., for starters. Gulf of Tonkin, which means the whole Vietnam War and why it was fought was a lie. Landing on the moon. Have you ever watched the YouTube press conference video of the returning Apollo 14 astronauts? Now might be a good time. How many Native Americans did we slaughter in order to raise our free and brave flag on a hill looking over San Francisco on the afternoon TV show Full House? The war on drugs, where we lock up people for decades for possession of a plant, and we love our beer commercials and our beer in the meantime. The war on immigrants, they are illegal. We point and cry from atop the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island. Look up Operation Northwoods and Iran Contra, the confession of E. Howard Hunt. Watch George Bush Sr.'s little speech at the Gerald Ford funeral on YouTube. It's all just a supreme joke when you get right down to it. The United States of America, that is. Does that all really relate back to the shooting of children in Connecticut, the so-called Boston bombings? I think it does. I do think it is absolutely all connected, just as I think the murders of JFK, RFK, and MLK are connected today, this morning, tonight. The ones who did those crimes and hid them are still here, still in control, still running their scam, motioning everyone up closer and closer to the stage, telling us it's this fantastic concert with free beer, when actually it's a hanging. And they are now doing crimes like killing children because they know we will then allow them to tighten the noose. We don't even see the rope. And they are very capable of pulling that trap door without us knowing the trap door is even there until it is too late. Well, there is a place, like no place on earth, a land full of wonder, mystery, and danger. Some say to survive it, you need to be as mad as a hatter. And if you come to understand this mad place, the others will tell you that you are entirely bonkers. But I'll tell you a secret. All the best people are.
It's the American dream. And you have to be asleep to believe it, Pope George Carlin I of the Bronx once said. We don't believe it. We don't believe in Barack Obama or the 9/11 Commission or Ronald Reagan or the U.S. military or the Warren Commission. We do believe in folks like Philip Berrigan and hundreds of others who over decades have pursued the new American dream, where the people will know the truth about the history of their own country. And because of this, they will be allowed to pursue not wealth and 900 TV stations and every jets and gadget imaginable at the cost of the lives of the people of Gaza and Iraq and El Salvador and Afghanistan. But they'll be allowed to pursue peace, prosperity, and good things through peace. We're Americans. It's an amazing time to be alive. We survived Kate Smith on the radio the whole month of September 2001. We survived Bush, so not all of us. How many will survive Obama is yet to be seen. It's morning. Time to wake up. There are no longer any questions we cannot ask. Nothing about our country we are not allowed to know. We are Americans. This is our country. This morning we take it back. From the CIA, the military, the bosses, the Warren Commission, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, the 9/11 Commission. Our children will study lies no more. Did George W. Bush, his father's friends actually steal the elections of 2000 and 2004? And if they did that, why would they ever stop at anything? Did George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, Condoleezza Rice, John Ashcroft, Paul Wolfowitz, Colin Powell, and others conspire to commit murder and treason in the 9/11 attacks? In order to again be able to lie about anthrax uranium, WMD, and torture. In order to attack Iraq and make millions, billions of dollars. We want to know, we need to know, we deserve to know. We want to know, we need to know, we deserve to know who killed Bobby, Martin, JFK, Wellstone. Did we land on the moon? How about climate change, climate manipulation, Fukushima, HAARP? Just asking. It's okay to ask. There are no wrong questions, remember? No secrets in anyone's land of the free. How do we explain to our children how the war on drugs goes with this much for you? Prisons, poverty, trees, sun power, wind power. We can talk about all of it because we're Americans again. We're not the subjects of the FBI or CIA or the U.S. Army or Wall Street. We do not torture, kill children, bomb, rape, mutilate. We are Americans. We are Americans. Why is Leonard Peltier in prison? Why do we fund death squads in El Salvador? We overthrew elected governments in Chile, Iran, Guatemala? Really? Why? We deserve to know. We need to know. We have to know. So that we may tell the world we are Americans. Don't be afraid to be a real American. Remember, they want us to be afraid, as they told us in the anthrax letters. We are not afraid. It is they who are afraid of us, as it should be.
Join us next week on One Day in the Life of an American Solzhenitsyn, when we will see the American prisoner thinking about looking for Bigfoot, UFOs, the Chicago Cubs, and stuff like that. And now a word from the Real History Channel. In Les Mis, at the very last and the final act, they sing, "We will walk behind the plowshare and put away the sword." It's the last scene at the barricades, triumphant over the bad guys. Do you hear the people sing, "Lost in the valley of the night"? It is the music of a people who are climbing to the light. For the wretched of the earth, there is a flame that never dies. Even the darkest night will end and the sun will rise. They will live again in freedom in the garden of the Lord. They will walk behind the plowshare. They will put away the sword. The chain will be broken and all men will have their reward. Will you join in our crusade? Who will be strong and stand with me? That such a movie or even such a line could be said in a major motion picture in the U.S., well, There are parts of the movie that have connections to our own situation, the poor, the rich, the broad disparity, the obscene disparity. And then there are people willing to fight. And then the last big closing scene with the huge barricades, the victory, the song, all that good stuff. Well, who knows what will come of our own situation, if there ever will be a triumphant, inspiring, goose-flesh, spine-tingling, big closing song. Probably, maybe the guys and gals we are fighting are a little more sophisticated than the French monarchy, but we'll do the best we can. And I guess we'll see, huh? One thing we can do is to notice. Notice the people who are doing the work these days, who are on the barricades, as they say. Also, remember your real history. Remember that the American Revolution started a long time ago. Remember that Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were on the barricades and were murdered in their beds by the Chicago police. Remember Mumia Abu-Jamal, the Omaha 2, Ed Poindexter and David Rice. Remember Leonard Peltier, David Gilbert. There are likely many others who today are still in prison for acts committed in the last century in resistance to the military of the United States of America. Then we have the Transform Now Plowshares, three Americans who were in prison lately for damaging United States of America nuclear weapons designed and produced in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. These weapons are made with the sweat and worry of taxpayers who work 9 jobs and get up at 5 to take their kids to daycare and have the express purpose of killing millions of people. And it is the folks who are trying to stop that who are facing long sentences for sabotage. Talk about being on the barricades. This has been a word from the Real History Channel. Our next guest of the evening is Anthony Rayson. Anthony Rayson speaks to us each month from Chicago. Anthony is a former tow booth operator on the Chicago freeway system. He is a prison advocate. He is a writer. He's a poet. an activist. He writes to for years and years. He's been writing to prisoners and corresponding with prisoners, getting their writing. And then what he does is he spends his own money and he publishes those writings. And you can find a collection of Anthony Racine's work online at the DePaul University website. And Chuck will be getting Anthony on the line right about right now.
Hello?
Well, hello, Anthony. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Well, thank you very much. Good to hear from you. I'm up in northern Wisconsin with my wife for the week. It's the first time in over 25 years we've had a chance to be together, just the two of us, so it's really been pleasant and relaxing. Today I want to read from a couple of prisoners that I work with, that I publish their work. One is Anastasia Schmid, who is a brilliant researcher who's incarcerated in Indianapolis, Indiana. And the other is a fellow, Matthew Smith, who's a prisoner at Mount Sterling, Illinois. So this I'll start with Anastasia's work, a couple short sort of stream of consciousness pieces. This one's entitled A Letter to My Alter Ego in Response to Zombieland. Reality is an illusion. Absolutely nothing exists unless we say that it does, either of our own accord or through collective agreement. I am the phoenix, so let's build upon the ashes of their ruins. I challenge people to think for themselves. The best revenge is living well. Heaven is here and now and of our own creation. To find bliss within the confines of this man-made hell is the ultimate slap in the face. The proverbial middle finger to the establishment. The system thrives on tearing down and destroying. Victory comes through building up and creating, beginning with the inner integral citadel. Wake up, old sleepers. You are God. I am not in prison, nor have I been for a very long time. And even a box or closet cannot prevent my dazzling shine. I am a light that cannot be extinguished or hidden. I have a way of touching people to spark transformation, profound enough that they leave prison and don't come back, a deliberate dismantling from the inside out, one brick at a time. Breathe life into those around you, and there was no match for their plans to further destroy. Live the example to show how it is done. I need not say a word. I don't have the answers. You do. Everyone does, buried inside them. But I do have the key that unlocks the door. The zombies are everywhere. Those who are here are merely the ones who live in a prison inside a prison, the hall of mirrors encased in the infinite binding of illusions. No matter how fucked up you are, I love you anyway, because I can see the genie inside your tattered and broken vessel. There is something far greater than the shell or the easily disillusioned mind that is the essence of you, of I, and it is impossible to destroy it, yet easy to conceal. I don't live in their world of lies and sleepwalking was-toids. There is an all-seeing cyclops in the center of our chests. Close the eyes in your head, and the smoke and mirrors disappear. We live in the land of the Sphinx. Riddle, a hole in the middle. What's that? My grandma drew circles in the air, repeating that chant without answer. Any answer you give is the correct one. Crazy is as crazy does. We are all one and the same. Of course we cling to death whenever we've never been shown how to live. Death equals hope for transformation and escape from the illusion. Shed the flesh and everything becomes real. The skin suit keeps you blind and stupid. We learn to love pain because it's intense extremity. You know you're alive when you hurt and bleed. There are two ways to die beyond the obvious. One, become void and numb to the essence of who and what you are, a willing participant in the illusory zombie circus hamster wheel of programming and conditioning, or two, choose a new reality. Choose your own adventure. Take one big bite out of my brain and fall in love with you in spite of yourself. I taste just like you, and the goddess is delicious. Nothing ever changes. Everything always changes. My good buddy Bill Murray implanted the chip. Fort Groundhog Day inside my mind while I slept. Oh, what a pretty little caged bird, turned into an antique heirloom for as long as she's been kept. Stuffed by the taxidermist of injustice, or maybe like a Thanksgiving turkey genocide, devour this flesh until there's nothing left. The food you'll then eviscerate from my guts because of my ignorance to trust. Every day is dress down day. I've had a nervous breakdown in a closet full of choices. My head's full of voices. What to do and how and when. My God, they've been even tried to silence my pen. Locked away for voicing my opinion. Minion to the system. Man, nothing ever changes. Automatons, void of original thought, file into the chapel so we can hypnotize you out of your free will and freedom to think and decide for yourself. Can I get an amen? Burn the witch, heretic. Oh, my God, not in front of the children. Good, let them see. Bring them right down in front. It's story time to open young minds. Everything always changes. Come on, come on, hand it over. Give me your last shred of dignity. Humility rifling through your shit. Surprise, a nice yellow crusty toenail hiding underneath the mattress right next to Elvis and Jesus. The prison version of the princess and the pea. The movers and shakers shaking us down, frown in disdain. Wipe that smile off your face. A surefire cure to laughter is being sprayed with mace. Brutality, do as I say. Prison sex has nothing to do with being gay. Black or white, right or wrong, there's never shades of gray. Nothing ever changes. Everything always changes. It's time to wake up. Hit the repeat button inside my brain. Maybe I'll get it right today. Here's one entitled Excerpt from Letters to a Liquid Paper Lover. Do you hold on just in case I'm not real? Did you run the first time because you thought it wasn't real? Too good to be true? Destroy it before it can destroy you. When you spend so much time wanting and trying to die, how do you kick that habit once you've found the reason to live? Does it become so confusing that it's easier to push the reason to live into the ultimate reason to die? Of course we need the physicalness when so much of our lives have been pushed aside and locked away alone, uncared for, unneeded, unwanted. The thoughts of those realities eating away at our minds like a virus, and the only solace was found in the pages of a book. A million lies and broken promises by the ones who should have loved you the most. Those who should form the core of trust and protection. Of course, facts, evidence, proof of existence becomes a requirement for everything. Nothing has ever been as it seems. So, of course, doubt underlies every person and situation. The greatest doubt is in ourselves. We know so much because we have the proof we need. We see it with our own eyes, and yet we cannot even trust ourselves to believe our own instincts in our own hearts. Hell, sometimes our own minds, rarely our own souls. My greatest fear is myself. I know exactly what I'm capable of in all extremes. What if we all lived up to our true potential? What is it you want? How do you know or not? Know if someone else sees eye to eye if you're too afraid to look. To tell what you want and need. The genie does exist, as does Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, God, and everything else. In the unseen realm, we are all of those things and more. Maybe what's truly crazy is that I was right all along. No need to spell it out or paint a picture. I am in you. You see behind my blue eyes. That place where we both get lost and are always found. The negative piece you wish to cut off isn't nearly as big as you think. The mess is beautiful to me. I find perfection in imperfection. Why would I not love you? Believe in everything. Everything we choose to believe in is what is. You write the script of your life, and if you know who you are, that no one else can play you. And you no longer take on roles that aren't you, and you weren't meant for you to play. I believe that life never ends, only changes form. I believe in me and in you, and we take two change forms. I believe in love. It flows constantly through it all. Magic happens in all things. Drop the backpack, baby. There's no need to carry the load. Those are little snippets from Anastasia Schmid. Her address is Anastasia Schmid, S-C-H-M-I-D, 122-585, 2596, Girls School Road, B6, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46214. She's really something. I'm going to go visit her before too long. Here's a few poems from Matthew Smith, who's incarcerated at Mount Sterling. His address, if you want to write to him, is Matthew Smith, B86629, 2500 Route 99 South, Mount Sterling, Illinois, 62353. Okay, this one is titled Isolation. I have no window in myself from which the world can be seen, so the world has become a distant memory, a fading dream. Thrown inside of this dungeon, I am left to rot, and I feel as if I fight in vain and struggle for naught. My family grows older, and some of them die, but the system doesn't allow me to hold them or to say goodbye. My comrades around me suffer the same abuse. Shoved inside isolated cells, we live like a recluse. I hear my comrades' voices on the gallery every day, yet there are only a few I have seen face to face. So many different questions my troubled soul asks. With no one to answer, they quickly melt into the past. I lay down each night, I have hope in my heart that tomorrow is when the change will start. All right. Talk to y'all later.
The staff, crew, producers, and roadies of the New American Dream Radio Show are proud to be sponsored this week by the Minutemen, guarding Americans' borders from poor people. Our own great-grandparents were poor, and they came here from other places, huddled masses, yearning to be free. We're fighting for freedom from poor people, taking aim at frightened lasses crouching by a tree. We urinate on the Statue of Liberty. We defecate on Dulles Island. We've got ours crunched tight in our cold, dead, clammy hand. In just 60 seconds, we're able to desecrate the whole idea of America. We are the Minutemen.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polachek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard. Ah, enough. I keep reading that I should honor our troops. On airline flights, I'm asked to applaud our young men in uniform. Why, for God's sake, what have our troops done for me except cause me great embarrassment, cost money better spent on anything else, and kill millions of people that I've had no interest in killing? For this, I am to thank them? No, they don't have noble motives. Men join the military because they need a job, because they want money for college, or because they are bored or want to prove their manhood or go to exotic places and get laid. Basic training, jump school, being a tank gunner, or doing nocturnal scuba insertions are much more appealing to a young man than selling fan belts at the Napa outlet. Patriotism, love of country, is an aftermarket add-on. Good for a drink or a pat on the back at the Legion. Nothing more than expression of the pack instinct that makes men in all places and times join in groups to fight other groups. The pack instinct is why tribal warfare is continual among primitive peoples, why war, otherwise inexplicable, remains incessant between modern countries. It is why the gangs of young males in Chicago mirror military hierarchy, with territory to be expanded or defended, with leaders and insignia, with hand signs to signify loyalty and identity. It is why people join screaming mobs in political conventions, why they become wildly emotional over football teams consisting largely of convicted felons who have nothing to do with the city. The pattern of loyalty inward to one's pack and hostility outward toward other packs explains the peculiar morality of the military.
A Marine colonel will be at home, a good neighbor, civic-minded, honest, cut the grass, help old ladies across the street. Come a war and he will mercilessly bomb any city he's told to bomb. And after killing, he doesn't care whom on the ground. He'll go to the officers' club where there will be high fives and war stories. We must not notice this or the other feral dogs will turn on us. If you say that soldiers are morally indistinguishable from mafia hitmen, you arouse outrage. But there is no difference. A soldier who's never heard of Vietnam or Iraq goes when ordered to kill Vietnamese and Iraqis, and duly kills them.
Guido and Vito, who have never heard of Hyman Blitzschein, the store owner who is behind on his protection payments, break Hyman's leg when ordered to. What is the difference? Morality is always a very thin veneer on top of the deeper savagery of the pack. Militaries encourage this savagery. From Joshua onward until very recently, armies regularly put cities to the sword, and generals allow their troops to sack and rape as rewards for good service. For those unfamiliar with such things, putting cities meant killing every living thing within. A graphic description of torture and murder routine in the 30 Years' War would have most readers retching. Today, this sort of thing, when exposed, is held to be in bad taste.
Only the United States engages openly in torture. Try putting Abu Ghraib in Google Images. But others do it. Of course, much depends on who's doing what to whom. When the Germans bombed London, the English thought it was barbaric. Later, when they were bombing German cities, it was a form of heroism. The rape of Nanjing was hideous, while the frying of Hiroshima was not. Killing everyone in a city of 100,000 by hand would be very bad PR, but burning them to death from above is cause for congratulations. An effect of the pack instinct is the suppression of cognitive dissonance.
Patriots, or the American variety anyway, cannot notice that our boys and our girls are committing the routine atrocities that armies normally commit. Call it cognitive indifference. American atrocities are always isolated incidents. An isolated incident is business as usual that is detected by the press. Thus, torture is best avoided by restricting coverage. It is Dave Ruger to speak of our boys fighting to defend America and our way of life, and to speak of their sacrifices. In the 50s, this spirit was exemplified by Superman jumping out of a window while the voice over intoned truth, justice, and the American way, then thought to be related.
Actually, soldiers are more sacrificed than sacrificing. Precisely how killing Afghan goat herds protects the United States is not clear. Careful students of geography have argued that Afghanistan is somewhere else. The evidence does seem to support this. Today, the motives of wars are usually disguised so as to be palatable. It's been said that the British fought for empire, the French for la guerre de France, the Russians to steal watches from the wounded, and the Americans for vague moral abstractions. Thus, Washington fights to rid Iraq of a cruel dictator while supporting many others just as cruel. Fights to instill democracy as if anyone anywhere cared whether Afghanistan were democratic. And to fight and to protect the world from non-existent WMD. The dog pack incident is most intense in the elite outfits, SEALs, Force Recon, Special Forces. With tightly bonded small groups, the focus of males working together, powerful free-floating hostility characterizes them. Patriotism gives them a cover story for doing what they would want to do anyway.
Loyalty to a small band of warriors is easily transferred to an abstraction such as country or religious faith. Being swept up in a cause gives an appearance of meaning to a life otherwise devoid of such. The flags, the hurrahs, the rhythmic thump, thump, thump of hundreds of boots, the solidarity, these reinforce the pack instinct, and recruiters and politicians know it. And so a coal miner who hates the coal company, hates suits and liberals and the rich and blacks and homosexuals, and knows he is being exploited and doesn't really like anybody at all except local friends, will discover unexpected loyalty when the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. And now, let's hear a huzzah for our boys.
The above piece is by Fred Reed, entitled Don't Honor the Troops, found at Information Clearinghouse. That's all, folks. That's the news, and we're out of here. Good night and good luck. And so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. It is what it is. At the end of the day, have a good day, and remember that you can start the revolution today by making direct eye contact with any policeman.
Our next guest of the evening is Larry Pinkney, and Larry Pinkney comes to us each month from Minneapolis. Larry is a former Black Panther member. He's an activist, a writer, a radio show host. He recently wrote the foreword to Cindy Sheehan's most recent book, and Chuck will be getting Larry on the line right about now.
Larry Pinkney speaking.
Well, hello, Larry. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Great. It's good to speak with both you and with Mike. Thank you very much. I'd like to address very briefly something that the entire nation and many countries or people in countries of the world are paying attention to, and that's the latest horror that people in this country have suffered, and I'm talking about specifically in Charleston, South Carolina, where there was the massacre of people in a church. And I think that it is extremely important for all of us, I don't care what our color is, black, white, brown, red, or yellow, all of us need to understand that our society is one that has been geared to violence. It's one thing, and it's very easy to sit back and to engage in recrimination. And while the event in South Carolina was indeed very horrible and certainly totally unacceptable, let us understand that the root cause, or the root causes, plural, of these kinds of things really go back to how we have dealt with things in our nation for centuries. We have got to make a change across the board, all of us. The fact that the black Americans that were murdered, at that church is very painful, of course, to me. But it's also very painful to me the murders that are taking place at the behest of drone man Barack Obama, the thousands and thousands of people who have been murdered by Obama's drones. And then this same president has the unmitigated audacity to talk about what a horrible thing this was. And it was horrible, but it's people like Obama and Hillary Clinton and John McCain, it's people like them who are facilitating this kind of insanity. And we all need to stop, take a deep breath, and look at things from the standpoint of what I call the root, R-O-O-T. I think it is imperative that we understand that our society needs to change its direction, change it. And the only way that that direction will be changed is for everyday, ordinary, black, white, brown, red, and yellow people to take the reins of power. And how do we take the reins of power? We stop supporting the Democrats. We stop supporting the Republicans. We stop supporting these corporate-owned whores, because that's what they are. And they're turning us into Pavlov's dogs, as the expression goes, who salivate at the very bits of vomit, because that's what it is, the vomit that emanates from the corporate stream media. Yes, of course, no doubt racism was involved. But what else is new? Whether we're talking about what happened many, many years ago in Tulsa, Oklahoma, or whether we're talking about what happened, you know, within the last few hours in South Carolina. The fact is that all lives matter, be they black, be they white, be they brown, red, or yellow. All of our lives matter. And it's time that we mature politically, emotionally, intellectually mature to understand that our nation must take a new, different, and I do mean radically different. And by the way, when I use the term radical, that word emanates or comes from the Latin word root, R-O-O-T. So oftentimes that word is misused. People in this nation especially have come to associate it with things that it is not to be associated with. All radical means is root. And we need to look and to address, to look at and to address the root causes of this insanity in our nation. As Dr. Martin Luther King said many, many years before he himself was assassinated, at the behest of this very government, by the way, Dr. King made it very clear that we have a government that is led by men and women who are misguided. I'm paraphrasing his words, where he talked about specifically misguided men and guided missiles. What do we have today? What do young people have to look at as an example today? And I don't care what the color is. What do our young people have to look at? How are they taught that problems or differences in perspective differences, and they can be very strong differences, but how are they taught that these differences are resolved? They are taught that differences are resolved through violence. That's how they're taught that differences are resolved. And the violence that I'm talking about is state violence. That is to say, the violence by the corporate-owned government. Poverty is violence. Abuse is violence. And this is what our nation continues. I call it the USS Titanic. It is time for us to understand that we need to make a complete turn around. We need to reject the vomit of the corporate stream media and the politicians, be they so-called right-wing or so-called left-wing, because we're not birds and we don't have wings. We're human beings and we have minds. And it is time for us to address these kinds of problems and challenges. You know, we have to address them honestly. It's not easy, but we've got to do it if we're going to change course. So, on that note, I want to remind everyone, again, don't care about your color or your gender. I want to remind everyone that it is time for us to make a change as brothers and sisters in the struggle. Okay? This is imperative, and it is indeed a struggle. So, as the old spiritual, some of you may remember that song, Oh Happy Day. It's a verse in that song, It was sung by the Edwin Hawkins Singers. It said, fight and pray. Fight and pray. Fighting in terms of what? Fighting for something, not simply against something. And when I say fight, I mean struggle. I mean struggle. I do believe that we in this nation have the capacity to change this nation, but not as long as we allow the misleaders of all colors to continue to lead us on the USS Titanic to the depths, to the abysmal depths of decadence and insanity. So take heart, my sisters and brothers. Take heart. Let's learn lessons from all of these horrors. Let's take these horrors and turn them around for ourselves, for our prodigy, for our children, our grandchildren. Let's do that. Remember the words of the Irish freedom fighter, Bobby Sands, when he said, our revenge will be the laughter of our children. So I urge everyone to take heart, as painful, and it is painful, very painful, as this matter in South Carolina and other places around this nation unfold. We must take heart and look beyond where we are in the direction of where we want to be, where we want to go. It is time for systemic change. It is time for systemic change. So as we said back in the day, in the original Black Panther Party, not the so-called new Black Panther Party, as we said in the original party, all power to the people. Everyday, ordinary, black, white, brown, red, and yellow people. Having said that, I'm hoping that I'm in some way raising the spirit of our listening audience, and I also want to thank our listening audience. I don't take you for granted. Thank you for listening in to the New American Dream. I thank Mike and Chuck for the opportunity to have these few minutes to express from my heart and from my mind precisely how I feel. So I'm going to end it there. Thank you so much. Stay strong, my sisters and brothers. Each one, reach one, each one, teach one, all power to the people.
Well, we thank you so much for being on our show each month. Your messages are inspiring. And I just have a thought about today. You mentioned here we are on the Titanic. Well, would you say that incidents like this this thing in South Carolina are the tip of the iceberg, and we're approaching some very rough times?
Yes, we are approaching some very rough times, and I like your metaphor, because indeed these things do represent the tip of the iceberg. What we need to do is to become the captains, if you will, the stewards, if you will, of our own destinies. We can do this. This is the only way we are going to survive as a species. And not only that, it's the only way we're going to serve our Mother Earth, which is very precious. There is no other Mother Earth like this Earth. So, yes, it is the tip of the iceberg, but we need to melt that iceberg. And the only way we can do that is being honest and making, pushing, demanding, organizing for systemic change.
Well, I'm with you, brother. and we have to always remember to help each other.
Yes. Absolutely. No one of us is as smart or as strong as all of us together. That's why I always try to remind myself and everyone else when I say, each one, reach one, each one, teach one. This is a we struggle, not a me struggle. It is a we struggle, and we can succeed. We will succeed. It's not going to be easy, but we can and we will and we must. So please, please, please take heart. Stay strong. Take heart. Let's learn from these things. Let's make sure that we minimize them in terms of them happening again and stop it from happening. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry. We'll talk to you next
month. Take care. Take care, brother.
Now, please join us as we look in on another episode of the new CBS reality TV show, One Day in the Life of an American Solzhenitsyn, a prisoner, an American prisoner, recently looked out from his prison window, a high prison window in the middle of a big city, down on the little people and little cars below. He was not allowed pencil or paper, but he was allowed to think. And as he did every day, he thought out the letter that he would send to everyone when he someday got that chance. He was for some reason sure that what he had to say would be news to those below, which it surely would be.
Is there anyone out there who thinks he's up to date with world events, wars, politics, environment? Jesus, I'm just saying, 30 or 40,000 people who die each day from starvation. Thousands of acres of Amazon forest that is supposed to be destroyed each day. The hole in the ozone layer growing faster than the bald spot on top of my head. That stuff real? And if it is, how do those numbers just keep rolling along and we're still here, merrily going about our day? I mean, it's frightening how much we don't know, at least given my own personal perspective. Don't know how my car works. Don't know what or who determines the price of gas. Don't know how the financial system works, the stock market. My mind goes immediately blank, like post-hypnotic suggestion, at the mention of the phrase debit or credit. I don't know how to produce my own food, clothes. Don't know how to build a house. Goes on and on. And I don't know who's in charge of my life. Really don't know if there's a God. What's really out there in the outer space, galaxies? Don't know how long I'll live. Some people are certain we will come back and live more lives. I'm not sure about that at all. And what if there's a heaven? Anything more frightening to think about than something never ending? Even if it is heaven? How does something never end? And I do not know who runs the country, the world. I know what I think based on some reading and what limited personal experience I had through just hanging around. But as far as actually knowing, well, I don't know. Maybe it's the best we can do to take our perceptions, however limited, pack them in the old Fred Flintstone lunchbox, go out the door, or go to work. So here I am. With my lunchbox sitting here open and my jelly sandwich and Oreos on my desk. Well, there is a place, like no place on earth, a land full of wonder, mystery, and danger. Some say to survive it, you need to be as mad as a hatter. And if you come to understand this mad place, the others will tell you that you are entirely bonkers. But I'll tell you a secret. All the best people are. Join us next week on One Day in the Life of an American Solzhenitsyn, when we will see the American prisoner thinking about the Minnesota Twins, tinfoil hats made out of cardboard, summertime classic cars shows, and stuff like
that. Hello, Chuck,
that.
I'm here.
Okay. Pick up with,
sorry
at the end
that.
Of the day, remember this day.
Okay, sorry about that. I don't know, my phone just has been dropping lately. Here we go. At the end of the day, remember that this day was brought to you by Operation Northwoods Spray Deodorant. With Operation Northwoods, the fog hangs in the air long after you've gone. Back a few decades ago, some people in government planned to carry out murders and crash airplanes and have fake news reports to fool the American people into invading Cuba. It didn't happen only because John F. Kennedy, a real president, was in office. But then the ones who liked the idea of Operation Northwoods killed Kennedy, and now we have fake everything. Fake presidents, fake news, and fake wars. Well, the killing and dying are real. It's just that everything else in baloney. Operation Northwoods, it hangs in the air. Hey, kids, hey, you, coming to town this summer, the Blue Angels, million-dollar killing machines you can sit in your lawn chair and see for 20 seconds rather than having a decent school building for your children for 12 years. Coming to a municipal airport near you to celebrate the killing of brown and white and yellow and black people by the United States Air Force in Iraq, Vietnam, Japan, Germany, pretty much everywhere. We are blue and red and white, celebrating murder and theft and global power for America and making more angels every day, everywhere. This program is also brought to you by Merca, the worldwide leader. There is no America. America was sold last century. We are now Merca. Merca is the new and improved, faster, thinner, tougher, sexier, made for the few. It's not your daddy's nation state, Merca. It's not for everybody. The 15-year-old Taco Bell girls softball team placed third in the weekend tournament at Mount Carl. They would have placed second or maybe first, but they didn't. They placed third. And on page 6 of the weekly Wednesday Miracle, everyone would have learned, but nobody read it, that 10,000 children in Central Africa had died from starvation and that 10,000 more would die in the coming week.
On the green ship tables outside the Liberty City swimming pool, fat people sat licking ice cream cones and wiggling their toes to get rid of the little red ants. A woman and a man were on one side of the table. She wore a two-piece cherry red suit with bits of hair like cactus poking out between her legs. The man wore jean shorts with the ends frizzled. His knees glowed red. The lunch area slumped outside the chain-link fence around the square pool. Two picnic tables outside the snack bar, which was part of the pool building complex. That also included changing rooms, bathrooms, showers.
The lifeguard blasted her whistle at someone taking too many warm-ups on the diving board. A droplet of sweet sweat formed on the forehead of the woman. It sat there, stuck for a moment in a crevice. Just at that moment, a unit of U.S. Marines opened fire on a group of civilians north of Kandahar. They walked up to their kill and bent down to claim jewelry, sunglasses, rings. One of the men took a pocket knife from his back pocket. He sliced the finger of the young boy at his feet. The blood gushed out, but he could still see to work. He sawed and sawed until he cut the index finger through, then reached to his other back pocket for a baggie and dropped the bleeding, swelling, bruising finger inside.
The pool was full of splashing and open mouths, like a trout farm tourist trap on the highway. A very similar sweat droplet, like the one on the woman, formed on the forehead of the man. He breathed deep to catch his breath. The lifeguard blasted her whistle again to signify break time. Everybody out. The man and woman looked at each other and then at their children. The droplets of sweat grew ever larger as the sun settled into 2 o'clock. No clouds were visible in the light blue. Both beads of perspiration began to move, heading intuitively for the nose passageway. Both man and woman began to breathe heavily. They looked at each other. The woman licked sweat from her upper lip with a cow tongue.
A man, a woman, now three children slid on their bellies on the rocks and burrs under the fence and looked both ways, then sprinted across the opening just as the white and green Border Patrol SUV pulled out from behind the bushes, throwing rocks the size of hand grenades, with lights flashing.
The ball of salt water on the woman's nose skidded down, flew off the nose, and slid over her sumptuous, closed, chewing mouth. She stared out over the parking lot like a Holstein on afternoon break. She ran her red tongue out long and licked the runny, melting, spent ice cream cone, keeping the bottom from dripping onto her gigantic, powerful thighs, and looked over at her man. She adjusted a strap on her suit by repositioning her bottom on the flaking bench. In the meantime, his sweat pustule leaked from his nose to his belly and held tight to a clump of hair, peering down into the black hole in the belly. He wheezed, coughed, and tried not to stop breathing. Her sweat found its way down and around the chin and whooshed playfully over the mogul's, down her neck, where it rolled and rocked like a small boat in an ocean storm, ending up on her bosom, where it stared into the darkness. He looked at her, and she at him, letting their accumulated sweat fall over their chests and legs, leg rash and red knees. They breathed deeply and stared at each other, mouths partially open for air like carp left on the bank on purpose.
The young U.S. soldier in Afghanistan carefully sealed the bag he closed, slowly running his index finger and thumb along the green lines. He folded the bag once and shoved the finger and baggie into his backpack as he readied to move on with the others, picking up his weapon as he stood. In the desert, the woman and man and three children ran, then ran faster. They split, running different directions like rabbits bred to the skill. The woman stumbled forward, her face and hands plowing up glass and rocks and brambles as the green and white Border Patrol vehicle skidded on two wheels to make the dirt corner, skidding to a stop. A dusty front tire just feeling her left temple.
The lifeguard blew her whistle, signaling that break time was over. Like frogs escaping the feet of a hiker, the swimmers leaped into the water. The woman opened her lips wide, let loose her longing, lapping, wet tongue, welcoming in the rest of her dripping, soggy, saggy, lifeless cone. She chewed once and swallowed. The man snorted and coughed and bent over to spit. He grabbed his knees and looked as if he might vomit, then sat straight to wipe his face with the back of his hand. The two got up to go back into the pool area as the children wiped their sticky fingers on the grass.
And now a word from All Things Really Considered. Whatever happened to NPR? They used to cover hunger strikes at Marion Federal Prison, and now they employ generals and NSA spooks, shills, and stumps. Who controls the media, book publishers, movie makers, newspapers, radio, TV? You wonder, don't you? Because you just know you won't see certain things in certain places, like on national public radio, All Things Considered. Why? If all things were really considered, studied, thought about, placed on the table, we would not be a nation of American idiots. This is All Things Really Considered. This is not Nina Totenberg, not Susan Steinberg, not Brian Naylor, not Scott Simon, Elizabeth Arnold, or Cokie Roberts. It's just not. It's just not. I believe the Black Panther Party was dangerous, not because they had guns, but dangerous in showing that it was possible to stand up to power. Angela Davis. Changing the inhumane way this world is run requires massive awareness of these horrible realities. All people, especially U.S. citizens, must know what their governments have promoted and the crimes against humanity they have committed, supposedly in the interest of their nation and their citizens. Awareness must lead us to action. It is everyone's moral obligation. Lori Berenson. We have all known the long loneliness, and we have found that the answer is community. Words are as strong and powerful as bombs, as napalm. Don't worry about being effective. Just concentrate on being faithful to the truth. Dorothy Day. Join us next week for another episode of All Things Really Considered. This is not Nina Totenberg, not Susan Steinberg, not Brian Naylor, not Scott Simon, Elizabeth Arnold, or Cokie Roberts. It's just not. It's actually interesting.
Well, it's been another long week in Newtown, my hometown, at the end of the empire. It's time for the publication of the new sophomore history textbook. The bread and butter of 3B1K Publishing House. managed by Nicostatus Greenberg in Newtown. Seems nobody is paying much attention to history these days. What is he to do? Well, he's running all over the grounds to talk to people to figure things out, for one thing. We find him now headed to talk to his daughters. Last week he visited the one who is a teacher at the public school, and now he's headed across the street, jaywalking to get to the little white house of the one who homeschools her kids. He stopped to sit on the statue and smoke his cigar, nodding at some kids hustling inside. He twisted the cigar out on the statue, stuck it into his coat pocket, and walked over to see Janie, who he hadn't always gotten along with the greatest every single freaking time. They always tried to do the big family thing with the big table, the big happy talk, but never worked that well that he could really remember. You might imagine in a family like the Greenbergs, history might be a big topic of conversation, but, well, it wasn't. It was more that the business of publishing history textbooks for sophomores in high school was kept at arm's length. Janie always wanted to pull it in close. Nick guessed he had not encouraged that. He crossed the street, stepped up over the curb onto the terrace, swung open the squeaky front gate, bent to move a yellow plastic automobile from the sidewalk, and left it. It was no use. The whole yard was scattered with primary colored plastic toys. He stepped over the little car and made his way up the broken cement steps to the loose metal screen door. He stepped into the front porch and saw a different story. It comprised a long, neat, tightly packed array of books and desks and tools for learning. Everything for the craft of education was on that long front porch, including beach balls, block, Legos, red plastic sets of protractor, ruler, and geometry triangles, arranged neatly inside the plastic everywhere. Voices pulled him inside, and the smell of the apple pie, the hot, gooey fragrance of homemade apple stuff. The little cluttered kitchen steamed and smelled sweet, and he wished someone would come in. This should be shared. A light door slapped somewhere, and running laughter brought him face to face with Janie, looking up at him, smiling, crushing her apron in her hands, her freckles pulsing with thought and action. Around her and behind gathered her children, his grandchildren. He could call one of them by name with a gun at his head. He would do it right now. He swiped his Yankees cap and pressed it to his stomach. Grandpa! They held out arms and moved closer, not quite touching, not quite speaking. Kind of dark in here, he said as he looked around. We run energy-efficient light bulbs, said one of the older girls. Saw you going over to the school. I didn't think we would see you, said Janie. She wore red hair and a long plait, big peasant hippie dress, no shoes, one gold tooth for emergencies. All the kids had one, which was weird, but his wife had insisted. They got teased at school, but someday they may thank us for that. They were still waiting. So he began counting heads with his eyes. Six, she said. You saw Abel on the front porch. It's his reading time. He likes it out there. Nope, said Nick. Nobody out there. You just didn't see him, said Janie. If he was reading, he didn't see you either. Hummed Nick. Janie'd always been sort of a history dissident. He supposed that was a polite way to put it. At the Thanksgiving adult big table, she complained that the others sent her to Siberia by rolling their eyes. Well, he said, picking up a shine stone with a hand-painted verse on it. This is nice. Janie said something to the children, maybe in another language, to sew, to paint, to wash dishes, to meditate, to exercise. We watch them go. We're just beginning the next mod, Janie said. You came at a good time. I did, he said. Nice. Would you like coffee, she said, already moving toward the stone pot on the old wood stove, grabbing a log from the floor and pitching it aside, grabbing the vessel with a worn mitt. Yeah, can you smoke on the porch? They both sensed all the children stopping to listen. She held the kettle still in the air to think. Sure, she said. Poured them each a full cup from the uneven handmade mug set, each with names and sayings and dates painted on. The children looked at each other as if they just smelled God fart. He headed for the porch. She followed with their mugs. The eyes are the key to the soul, she said, as she sat on a wooden chair. The fingernails are the window to the heart. Nick looked at his hands, torn, bloody stubs. Well, there he is, he said, now noticing Abel scrunched at the end of the porch. Nick sat on the sofa, darting looks at the boy reading, immersed with narrow eyes, brow furrowed, feet twitching, hand twirling his long hair. Nick looked at the cover of the book and read the title out loud. Lies My Teachers Told Me. He chuckled. That's you. No, not me, said Janie. You're his teacher, he said. Oh, I get it. Lies. Like what lies? It's a joke book. I get it. You got me there. How old is old Abel's 10? Nick counted on his fingers. That would be fifth grade, huh? Well, yes, if he were still. He reads at freshman college level. If that textbook would ever be in a regular high school classroom, it would be about sophomore level. Lies, said Nick. What lies? Abel dropped the book flat to make eye contact with Nick. There are so many, he said. So, even you teach history, Nick said to Janie. It's what he's interested in. It was really my idea, believe it or not. Stay on the same page, said Nick. Right, take it to the next level, I know, right? Janie adjusted something on her dress. Abel waited for Nick to speak. Nick turned to Abel. Well, I'll tell you. My plan is to change the book. You know, our book, the book, right? Abel nodded. Isn't it time, you know, for the new book, said Janie? It's too late for that. We don't have any choice. That's what I told Honey White Bear. Oh, her, said Janie. I told her we got to change everything. That's what I'm thinking. We got to change the cover, change the insides, the pageant, the title, the subtitle. She said it cannot be done. It should not be done. What would your grandfather and father have said? I said, I don't smucking know. Sorry, but this is my call. I got to make the decision. It would impact everything, said Janie. Are you sure about this? It would change your whole business. It would affect your family, the whole town, the whole country, perhaps. Probably, said Nick. The whole world, said Abel. I think you should. Have you asked Uncle Mick and Aunt Helen, said Janie. Nope, said Nick. They're never around. Why should I? Don't you think you should? Nope. He pulled the stub from his jacket pocket, dug in his pocket, scrounged in the other pocket. Here, said Abel, sitting up, leaning forward, holding out a candle for Nick to light his cigar. That's the news from Newtown, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards. And all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average. And that just about wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight. We hope you'll be back next week and every week. And that in the meantime, you'll stop by our website, newdream.us, and listen to the archived shows that you can find there. We've been on the air since February 3rd of 2011. I'd like to thank you, Mike, and good night.
And thanks also to our guests, Larry Pinkney, Anthony Rayson, and M.K. Davis. And so good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Muhammad Atta. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.